Eventually, quiet will set in. And I fear that Israel will fall back in love with the quiet and will neglect, to some extent, the vigilance that it will require to prevent the Hamas from being able to recoup itself and reconstitute itself.
Welcome to the Misgav Institute for National Security's Mideast Horizons, the podcast for anyone who wants to truly understand what is happening in the Middle East beyond the headlines and spin. I'm Lahav Harkov, your co-host, a Misgav Institute senior fellow and senior political correspondent for Jewish Insider.
And I'm Asher Fredman, your co-host, executive director of the Misgav Institute and a visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation. The Misgav Institute is Israel's leading national security policy institute dedicated to strengthening Israel's security, its regional cooperation, and its international alliances. Each week on Mideast Horizons, we bring you fresh insights into the most critical issues on the Middle East and Israeli national security agenda, as well as key insights into the incredible trends and opportunities taking shape in the Middle East.
Please subscribe and follow wherever you listen to podcasts to keep up to date and ahead of the curve on everything connected to the Middle East. You can reach out to us with comments and suggestions at MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com.
And we read your responses, we respond, so please keep sending them, and we appreciate your ideas and suggestions. This week, we have on our podcast Israeli-American author and journalist Yaakov Katz, who just recently published, together with Amir Buchbot, a new book entitled While Israel Slept. This book looks deep into the intelligence, military, strategic failures that led to October 7th, that led to the worst massacre of Jews since the Holocaust, but doesn't just look at what happened in the past, extracts lessons to make sure that we don't repeat the same failures in the future. Lav, while we're looking at past terror attacks, we here in Jerusalem suffered a terrible terror attack just yesterday. My girls go to school there just a mile away from where the terror attack happened. And obviously, we were very nervous for a short while until we got them on the phone. What can you tell us about the terror attack and its aftermath?
So two Palestinians from Judea and Samaria opened fire at a bus outside Ramot, which is a neighborhood in Jerusalem, killing six people and injuring about a dozen people. Two Israelis who were at the site of the attack killed the terrorists. One of them was actually a soldier from the Hashmonaim, the Hashmonaim unit, which is the new Haredi combat section of the army. So he's been trained well to take action and to protect his fellow Israelis, but it was a really, really tragic attack. And it also took place on a day that four Israeli soldiers were killed in Gaza. So it was a very difficult and tragic day.
Yesterday was a very difficult day. The response of that soldier also showed the importance of training young Haredi men in the IDF to have security training. The attack is also a reflection of the situation in Judea and Samaria, in the West Bank. We still don't know that much about the attackers, about their motivations. It's being investigated right now. But the best available Palestinian polling shows that Hamas is by far, by I think 50% over Fatah, the most popular party in the West Bank, that there is nearly 50% support for armed struggle, i.e. terror, in Judea and Samaria, in the West Bank. The most recent Palestinian polling from May 2025 shows that 59% of the Palestinians in the West Bank think that Hamas's October 7th attack was the right decision. Now that's
more than Gaza.
More than Gaza. So after 2 years of terrible destruction and suffering, they still think that Hamas's decision to launch that attack was the right decision. That's in the background of continuing Palestinian Authority incitement to terror in schools, on streets, the continuing Palestinian Authority payments to terrorists, and all this come together to create what is still a very explosive atmosphere in Judea and Samaria.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a lot of soldiers on the ground. I mean, there's always a lot of soldiers in Judea and Samaria, but also they're bringing in a lot of reservists who are going into certain Palestinian areas and trying to basically forcibly demilitarize them, going house to house, looking for weapons, clearing them out. And this is happening every day. It's not getting a lot of attention because of the war in Gaza. But I have heard that there are sort of security warnings and concerns that things are going to heat up in that front. As we always hear, really, when we approach the Jewish holidays of, you know, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, and that's in 13 days. So it's usually actually a hotter time, more difficult security atmosphere in Israel. And, you know, one of the lessons that we learned from October 7th, which you would have hoped we would have learned 50 years before from the Yom Kippur War, is that our enemies don't rest when we have, when we celebrate holidays. And in fact, they think it's a good time to take advantage and attack us. So definitely have to keep an eye on that area, which is unfortunately heating up.
You know, Israel, since October 7th, has moved to this strategy of preemption, let's call it, of not allowing strategic threats to take shape. And we see that in Iran, but we see that obviously in Lebanon and Syria and with the Houthis as well, and of course in Gaza. And we've been advocating that that strategy is the necessary strategy in Judea and Samaria as well. In the past, Israel's security officials would often want to try to keep arena as quiet as possible. And even if that meant, while Israel was focused on other arenas, so even if that meant ignoring or downplaying or using a very light touch on terrorist attacks as they were being formed or terrorist planning, and the idea being, let's not, you know, heat up this arena right now. Let's not lead to a wider conflict. Let's, you know, keep out. And when the terrorist attack becomes serious, when they try to enter Israel, then we'll swoop in. And we've been advocating at the Miskav Institute for a different approach, saying we can't allow something, we can't allow another Gaza situation to come up in Judea and Samaria. And therefore, as soon as we have an indication that terrorists are beginning to plan something, or beginning to organize, or producing weapons, Israel needs to move in and to root out those threats.
Yeah, and as I said earlier, there are Palestinian towns, you know, they call them refugee camps, but like these are refugees from 1948 and people live in permanent housing. So I kind of hate to use that term. It just is a completely misrepresents the situation. So there are Palestinian towns where the IDF has really just moved in and tried to clear it of all weapons. So to some extent, I do think that they're implementing that. And certainly with the security warnings that we see for the next month, I think the IDF is really on alert. But maybe something else, there's an argument going on about security and Judea and Samaria, a different kind of argument, which is that there are some in the current government who want Israel to move forward and apply sovereignty to part or all of Judea and Samaria.
But Lev, why do Israeli decision makers tend to use the phrase apply sovereignty and not annex, like you usually hear in the international media?
There's a few different things. I mean, there's the sort of philosophical claim of like you can't annex land that historically belonged to you, which there's the, of course, the biblical argument, which basically that was actually the heartland of Israel in the times of the Bible. But more recently, right, you know, you had the San Remo conference, you know, and then 100 years ago or so, like that was supposed to be part of the eventual Jewish home, you know, and so people make national law, international law arguments based on those kinds of the documents that came out of those conferences about the future sort of that land. So there's a few different reasons. I think the bottom line, though, is that annexation sounds bad and applying sovereignty sounds a little more neutral. And I think that that's an attempt at giving it better PR because it's going to be controversial no matter what.
It's interesting. If you ask, what is it actually mean on a technical level? So on a practical level. So today, as many people might not be aware of this, if the Knesset passes a law, it doesn't automatically apply to Jewish communities in Judea and Samaria. It doesn't automatically apply to Efrat, for example, as one example of a large Jewish community in Judea. These communities are still under the administration of the IDF Central Command. And the IDF Central Command essentially has to, it's a little bit more complicated, but essentially has to implement or apply the law to the Jewish communities there. Once Israel applies sovereignty, what that means on a practical level is essentially that a law passed in the Knesset automatically applies in Efrat, doesn't have to go through the IDF Central Command. Same thing with regulations and planning and zoning and environmental regulations. The Israeli law will apply to the Jewish communities in Judea and Samaria as well. That's not that big a deal on a practical level. Of course,
I mean, it depends what those laws are, right? You're talking about construction and zoning. So I always say, because in the international media, people will always talk about settlement construction, right? And it sounds like every bit of construction in quote unquote settlements is you're building a whole new town and you're taking more land away, quote unquote, from the Palestinians. And most of the time it's actually new homes that are being built within the city limits of an existing town, right? So I think that's also like, we can't lump everything in together and say it's not a big deal. Like I remember years ago, it might even be 10 years ago now, there was a law passed that said that like tourism related laws and regulations would also apply to Judea and Samaria. And then you had these international headlines that were like, it's creeping annexation. And like, come on, like it's tourism. Like there are tourist sites there that Israel already manages. It's not a big deal. But I do think that certain construction and zoning laws are a big deal, right? Because then you're changing the map. So not everything is the same, but maybe things like education, local policing, tourism. So those things, like in any case, the situation is the same as regular Israel, except that the army just signs a piece of paper.
But I do think on the political level, on the international diplomatic level, it's also a big deal because essentially if Israel does decide to officially apply its sovereignty to parts of Judea and Samaria, 82%, the Jordan Valley, the settlement blocks, whatever it might be, it's a statement that they are now rejecting the Oslo framework of a two-state solution. And they're rejecting it in principle and they're going to act, whether it's construction in E1 or construction in other areas, without regard to this idea of a contiguous independent Palestinian state. And now that is a big deal. Now, to be honest, for most Israelis, and I was in the Golan last week, and as you're driving around the Kinneret, under the heights of the Golan, the Kinneret, the Sea of Galilee, and you think about how the Syrian army was sitting up on those heights and shooting down at the people driving along the Kinneret, the Sea of Galilee. And I think for most Israelis, the idea that there could be a Palestinian military or a Hamas-dominated military on the hilltops overlooking Tel Aviv or overlooking Jerusalem, overlooking Ben Gurion Airport, is a non-starter. So the idea that the Oslo envisioned of having, you know, this armed Palestinian entity over on the hilltops overlooking Israel's major metropolitan centers, I think is really off the table for most Israelis. And the question is it the right thing to do to formally apply sovereignty and formally make the declaration that the Oslo era is over? I actually think
think that's the only declaration you're making, right? Like, I think that other people are going to read that declaration differently. I mean, it's not just, I think for a long time now, it's been pretty clear to anyone who's actually involved in paying attention that the exact parameters of Oslo weren't what was going to happen, right? That, you already had in the days of George W. Bush, the Annapolis and this and that, that you would maintain, or actually I think already in the days of Bill Clinton, that you would maintain the major settlement blocks, right? This wasn't going to be a 1967 lines kind of situation. You're closing the door on any kind of two-state solution, which, while at this point, I think most Israelis agree with that, and certainly this government does, it has broader ramifications, right? So right now you have the Emiratis making all kinds of statements about how it undermines the spirit of the Abraham Accords. And that's something I think Israel has to consider. Now, listen, like, we didn't establish this country in order to have relations with the UAE, right? Like, we established this country for different reasons, and Israel's national security needs are number one. But having a Middle East where we can normalize ties with a lot of other countries and cooperate on security and intelligence is also important to our national security. So I don't think it's a very difficult decision at this time.
Absolutely, I agree. And as you know, I've been working for the last 5 years on the Abraham Accords and deepening ties between Abraham Accords countries. I think more important than the question of state, non-state, declaring sovereignty is for Israel to decide what it wants for the future of Judea and Samaria. There's all different various plans and options and how to organize relations between Israelis and Palestinians, what kind of Israeli security control, what kind of administrative control it wants in what areas. I think what Israel needs to do is to define for itself and for its partners around the world, for the international community, what it wants. Does it want there to be a one Palestinian authority, or does it want there to be all different separate Palestinian entities that it works vis-a-vis each of them. And that has its own complications, right? Are you going to coordinate vis-a-vis five or six Palestinian police forces? On the other hand, if the PA is unsavable or so, drowning in incitement and corruption that there's really no point in trying to save it, or if it collapses on its own when Abbas leaves the world stage sooner or later, then what does Israel do? I think once Israel defines, and once Israel also looks at other international, I mean, there are dozens of territories around the world that have various degrees of independence, autonomy, statehood, control. I think once Israel decides what it wants, and it can look at also other internationally accepted models, then it can communicate. You could call it a state, you could not call it a state, but then can communicate to itself, to the United States, to its partners in the Middle East, explain why it's choosing this model, and then work to implement it.
Yeah, I agree. And this has been like the long standing problem in Israel, especially for the Israeli right, which is to say, like, they say no to Oslo, they say no to a two-state solution, but there isn't a broadly accepted thing that people say yes to on the Israeli right. And there are all kinds of different plans. Back when I was in college, I worked for one of those organizations, for Rabbi Benny Alon of blessed memory. But nothing has become like broadly accepted as like, this is the answer of the right. And so the result of that is that it looks like Israel doesn't know what it wants. And Israel needs to know what it wants. Israel needs to make decisions for its future. I can understand the attraction of just trying to maintain the status quo, but sometimes, you know, other things catch up with you, which, again, we tried to maintain the status quo in Gaza, and that caught up with us in a very tragic way. So that's just, you know, sadly, similar things can happen in Judea and Samaria.
So talking about Gaza, we had reports this week of a new American offer by President Trump and Special Envoy Witkoff to Israel, to Hamas, regarding a deal for releasing all the hostages and an end to the war. Israel, I think Foreign Minister Gideon Saar today officially announced that Israel accepts the deal. Hamas's response has basically been, you know, there's all different leaks and reports, but basically, great, let's start negotiating. I'm willing to sit down to talk. What do you think? What do you think? Do you think there's a chance that this deal gets accepted, that we see an end to the war? What's your take?
Well, hot off the presses, Asher, as we're speaking, Jewish Insider is publishing an article of mine, although by the time the podcast comes out, the article will be a day old, that the Hamas official Bassem Naim has rejected the deal. I don't really understand why almost nobody's reporting this in English. Like, I literally am only finding it in English in like pro Hamas websites, basically, and one tweet by an Israeli journalist in English. But Bassem Naim, who's a senior Hamas member based in Istanbul, he called it a humiliating document of surrender, compared it to, he said, we don't have an Emperor Hirohito in Hamas. So I don't think that it's going anywhere, certainly as far as Hamas is concerned. But, you know, you never know with Hamas, right? They could say one thing one week and the next week they say another thing. So if we want to take it seriously, it's a very open kind of deal. The beginning of the deal is detailed, which is that in the first 24 hours, and then I understand it was updated to 48 hours, all the hostages would be released in exchange for many Palestinian prisoners who are in Israel. And then there's a 60-day ceasefire, during which the end of the war is meant to be negotiated. We don't know how far Israel would have to withdraw to within Gaza and when, right? And Israel, Hamas wants Israel to withdraw entirely from Gaza. Israel wants to retain a security perimeter around Gaza, including the Philadelphia corridor along the border with Egypt. It doesn't say Hamas needs to lay down its arms. I mean, it doesn't say anything otherwise, right? It just doesn't get into it. And Hamas, in that same statement that I was talking about, the Hamas official Bassem Naim says that Hamas has a right to have weapons and a right to resistance, which we all know means murdering Israelis. And of course, Israel wants Gaza to be demilitarized and for Hamas to be disarmed. And then also Israel wants there to be sort of an alternative administration of some kind of Gaza, which Hamas has said it's open to. But of course, if Hamas also wants to retain weapons, like, anybody who's there will have to be a puppet of Hamas or be murdered. So I'm not saying it's a bad deal. I'm just saying that it's a deal where very little is actually worked out other than the hostage part, which means it could end up which means I'm very skeptical that Hamas will agree to it, because if they give up all the hostages on day one or day two, then again, they don't have their leverage left. It's their, you know, evil view that these people are leveraged.
When I saw the first report, I tweeted right away, there is no way that Hamas is ever going to accept this deal, because Hamas is, in my view, tragically, never going to, certainly is not going to release all the hostages on day one or day two. That's just a non-starter for Hamas, because I don't believe there's any guarantee. My understanding is that President Trump, the American administration, is saying, essentially, rely on us. We will guarantee that Israel does not resume the war as long as negotiations are ongoing. And I just don't think that's enough for Hamas. Hamas is not willing to rely on that kind of guarantee. I don't think there's any guarantee. There's been reports, well, they want a UN Security Council resolution. If there's a UN Security Council resolution, and then Hamas is preparing for another terror attack, do they really believe that Israel is not going to respond because the UN said they shouldn't respond? I think that, in my view, the only realistic scenario in which Hamas releases all the hostages is over a long process. So first, they'll want all the reconstruction material to come into Gaza, and they'll be able to rebuild their military infrastructure and capabilities. They'll want to see that Israel has fully left Gaza and essentially demobilized, redeployed outside of Gaza along the border fence. They want time to go by so that Israel sort of returns to normal, so that the chance returns to normal, returns to not being at war, so that the chances of restarting the war are diminished. In that scenario, who knows, 6 months, a year, 2 years down the line, when Hamas has been able to get everything it needs to rebuild its military capabilities, when it's seen that Israel has left the Gaza Strip and has really ended the war and has essentially moved on. In that scenario, I think Gaza might release the last living hostages. But beyond that, I don't think there's any chance that, again, I wish I was wrong, to be honest, even though it doesn't have all of those important elements that you mentioned, the demilitarization, I would support this deal if we got all 48 hostages back home tomorrow. But I just don't think there is any chance. And I think Israel did the right thing by announcing that it was willing to accept the deal. I don't think there's any chance, sadly, that Hamas will accept this deal.
Yeah, I agree with you. Our guest this week is Yaakov Katz. Yaakov Katz is an author, journalist, and senior fellow at the Jewish People Policy Institute. He was the editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post, where he was my boss and my previous podcast co-host. Before that, he was senior policy advisor to Naftali Bennett during his tenure as Minister of Economy and Minister of Diaspora Affairs. Yaakov is the author of four books, including the new While Israel Slept.
He's also the founder of the Middle East America Dialogue, a premier forum for American, Middle East, and Israeli decision makers to come together, thought leaders to come together, discuss the key issues on the table. So without further ado, Yaakov Katz.
Yaakov, welcome to the show. Good to be reunited with you on a podcast.
Always fun to be with you guys.
We're here to talk to you about your new book, While Israel Slept. And I want to open up by talking about the book. There's been so many books about October 7th. What is different about yours? What is it that people can learn that they didn't learn from the other books?
Well, I mean, you kind of set me up to, I would be mistaken if I didn't say that it's obviously the best book. But putting all joking aside, I think that one of the pieces of investigative reporting, or just in general reporting, that had been missing from the conversation about the events of October 7th was a look at the entirety of what had happened. There had been so many stories, of course, of what happened in the night between October 6th and October 7th. What were the different alarm bells that we now know were sounding and ringing and going off in IDF headquarters and Shin Bet headquarters? What were the earlier signs that we know about? For example, the reports that the Tatzpitaniyot, the female spotters, the surveillance soldiers, had been warning their commanders about, had been telling them that we're seeing things that are out of the ordinary, but they had been shut down. The different reports that one was written by Avigdor Lieberman himself back in 2016 when he was defense minister, literally outlining one-to-one what was eventually going to happen one day and did happen, or the Jericho Walls report that came out in 2022 and also one-to-one was depicting what would happen and never made its way to the defense minister. So there's that piece of it. But what we also did in the book was try to really uncover, how did Israel fall into a state of complacency from the perspective of, How did the policy of containment become get created? And I think that it's a process. It was a journey. It wasn't a decision, as much as people would like to believe. It wasn't a decision that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu just made one night or one day. Now we're going to contain Hamas and we're going to send them suitcases of cash from the Qataris. This was a long process. It had an incubation process. And much of it goes back even to just the way Israel approached the Gaza issue and Hamas from the beginning of Hamas when it was first founded in the 1980s. So we really wanted to try to understand how is containment created? Where does it come from? What are the motivations for it? And from, I would say, a forward-looking perspective, how do we, as Israelis and as a country, how do we prevent this from happening again? Because my deepest fear is that this could happen again. It, not because Hamas will so easily rebuild, but because Israelis will very easily want to fall back into the quiet zone. We'll want quiet. We'll see there is some quiet, and we'll want to try to preserve and retain.
What was the alternative? Meaning, it's once after October 7th happened, we can point to all the failures that led to the worst massacre of Jews since the Holocaust. But if we go back and we look at the years in which the mindset or the ideology or the paradigms that enabled October 7th happened, what should Israel have done differently, whether it's 2007, 2014, 2018, 2021, all these various points where Israel faces the decision to act differently? And I guess the question also goes to, could Israel have acted differently? Was there internal and international legitimacy for removing Hamas from power back then? Or maybe we needed an October, it's hard to say this, but maybe we needed an October 7th to change the paradigm.
Obviously, it's very easy for me to sit here now and say we should have, would have, could have, and we should have acted differently. We should have done things in a different way, and that could have prevented October 7th. I think one thing that Israel definitely could have done is really stood by what two different prime ministers promised they would do, Ehud Olmert and Benjamin Netanyahu, and topple Hamas. And refuse to accept a reality that a genocidal terrorist group is living alongside our border. And that's just a fait accompli. That's the way it is, and there's nothing we can do about it. And, I mean, it goes deeper, Usher, because if we look at the way Israel approached Hamas and approached Gaza, it was as if we're stuck. We don't have an alternative. The best case scenario is this game of whack-a-mole. Every 2 years or so, we hit them on the head. We have a bit of a skirmish, right? We pull out of Gaza in 05. 06 is Summer Rains operation after Gilad Shalit is kidnapped. 08, 09 is Cast Lead. 2012, Pillar of Defense. 2014, Protective Edge. It was as if this is just the reality, and there's nothing we can do, and this is how it is. So every 2 years or 2.5 years, we come to blows with one another. And in the end, what also set really deep into was became entrenched in thinking in the military and in the political echelon was, well, we can create economic assets for them. They don't have what to lose. So let's give them what to lose. So let's build up the economy. Let's give them money. Let's let in Palestinian workers, right? You both remember, a lot of you especially, because you cover this so closely, how when Naftali Bennett became prime minister in the summer of 2021, He was announcing to the whole world with great pride how he allowed in 10,000 workers, 15,000 workers, and how this is quiet and how his period was the quietest period. By the way, we now know that during his period as prime minister, they were preparing for this invasion, and he just got lucky that it didn't happen on his watch. So I think that the difference could have been on a very macro level to not allow Hamas to grow in this way. But the issue also strikes at Israel's national defense doctrine until October 7th. And that had been for many, since Israel's establishment pretty much, we do not launch preemptive wars over conventional military buildups. So, for example, we never went to war against the Syrian army because they were amassing tanks or artillery or ballistic missiles. We never went to war against Hezbollah because they were amassing an arsenal of 150,000 rockets. On the contrary, we were afraid of Hezbollah. But the same applied to Hamas. Where we preempted was only in the nuclear arena, but not in conventional military threats. That has changed. The issue of preemption is now seems like is setting in as the new policy for Israel, which is, by the way, the only way forward, pretty much.
I mean, arguably, Israel preempted in 1967. Maybe it was like the last second, but yeah.
That's the one.
But that's like the exception.
That's the one exception, and that's the. And by the way, even within the exception, there are those who would argue that there were already acts of war that were committed against Israel, closing Straits of Tehran and doing things along those lines that already, it wasn't even a preemptive war, it was a defensive war. But you're right, that is the one example.
If we zoom in a little bit more than like the broader, you know, concept of Israel's security or the broader sort of philosophy of Israel's security, one of the things that a lot of people talk about is over-reliance on technology as opposed to really just having more people on the ground. And what role do you think that played in the failure of October 7th? And do you think that's changing now?
Well, I think that containment, in my view, after working on this book, had three legs to it. One of those legs is technology, and I'll talk about that in a moment. The other two, just very quickly, is the we have bigger fish to fry, right? We have bigger issues. We have Iran. We have Hezbollah. Hamas is at the bottom of the totem pole, and therefore, if you can, you don't want to get distracted because you need to deal with the bigger issues. So keep Hamas contained. Don't deal with it. I think the third leg to containment is a bit more political and controversial, and that is the political value from the perspective of the prime minister of having a divided Palestinian people to be able to prevent any moves towards a Palestinian state. But put that, I know that's a bit controversial, but put that aside. But about to your question of technology for a moment. 100%, this is the main leg of containment, was a belief by Israel that it could contain Hamas. Now, this splits into two different types of technology. Technology number one is the defensive technology that Israel had created for the Gaza Strip. Iron Dome, right, was able to swat missiles out of the sky like they were mosquitoes. It made it seem like the missile threat is nothing. It's not a strategic threat. It's barely anything of a threat. So they can fire missiles and we just go on with our lives. And they can amass more rockets and more missiles and fly them even farther to Tel Aviv and then even to Jerusalem and beyond. But they don't mean anything because we just blow them out of the sky. Then you all remember 2014 during Tzuk Eitan, that operation in the summer, when they start popping out of tunnels, right? And they start killing soldiers. And the Netanyahu was reluctantly pushed into an operation inside Gaza where he didn't want to send the ground forces in, and he sent them only in 2 kilometers deep, but all aimed at trying to destroy those cross-border tunnels. And then in the aftermath of that war, the best of the best, the brains, the smartest of the smartest in Israel get together. How do we stop the tunnels? So they do two things. They build the iron wall underground, down to the aquifer, which can block the tunnels. Then they put these teams of the smartest soldiers and scientists together, and sonar experts, seismic experts, geologists. We tell these stories in the book of how they come up with a system that can detect where a tunnel is being dug, when it's being dug. They're so sensitive that they can almost tell what tool is being used to dig the tunnel, a jackhammer, a shovel, a bulldozer. Now, you both know the answer to this question. How many people crossed into Israel on October 7th in a tunnel? Zero. They blew about 60 different points of entry in the border, and that's where they came in, all above ground. I mean, the technology created a false sense of security, that they were there and we are impenetrable. So that's technology one. Technology two is the reliance on technology for intelligence collection. One of the questions that I wondered a lot about was, how is it? Eventually, 3,000 people or so cross into Israel that day from Gaza. Now, not all of them are Nukba, the Hamas elite forces or the Hamas terrorists. A lot of pillagers and looters who eventually come in and steal and kill, unfortunately, also, and rape. But not all Hamas. But you understand that in the beginning, there were definitely hundreds of Hamas who were in that initial wave. And there wasn't a single one who could call up his Israeli handler and say, hey, we're coming. We had no agents, informants on the ground in Gaza. We thought we knew everything by listening to them, by watching them. But we had neglected the basics of intelligence collection, which is human, to human intelligence. And that's something that the IDF and the Shin Bet have been investing a tremendous amount of resources in the almost 2 years since October 7th, to build up those capabilities, which, by the way, we see, and this is what's so painful, you see that when you contrast Gaza with Lebanon, the amazing pager attack, wow, incredible, what Israel did in Iran, taking out nuclear scientists, the top military leadership, you see that when Israel allocates the resources and the attention and the focus, it can do incredible things. Here, we did not allocate resources. We did not allocate the attention and focus. And this is what happened.
So if you have to break down the different elements of the conceptia, the mindset or the preconception or the false paradigms, it seems that the actual, even though people like to talk about the conceptia, really what we're talking about is several different false beliefs or mindsets. One is an over-reliance on technology. One is the belief that Hamas could be bought off by money, is interested primarily in economic development. Another perhaps is that Hamas, with its capabilities, isn't capable of creating a real strategic threat to Israel, even though obviously 251 hostages and thousands of terrorists crossing the border is a real strategic threat. Are there other elements or strands of this conceptia, of this preconception, that contributed to October 7th?
Well, I mean, each one of those is a whole Torah in of itself. But I think that the belief, and this is the real question, right? Can you even deter a terrorist organization that is bent on your destruction? And that's the deeper question, right? And that was Israel's premise was that they can be deterred. You can constantly maintain the deterrence. You can kick the can down the road. And that this is the best case scenario for Israel. And I think that some people are not wrong who claim, and this falls into a very heated debate that's taking place right now, is decisive victory possible? What does decisive victory look like? And is decisive victory something that Israel needs to strive for? Or does Israel need to accept the reality that Hamas will remain in one way or another and try to find a different way out of this war? And I think that there is no alternative to a defeat for Hamas that it feels that it has completely lost in this war. And it's not a deterrence, it's a defeat. And that's something those are two very different words and have very different meanings. So I think the general mindset of Israel, of what it's capable of accomplishing and achieving, is something that also is important. And that ties into our cultural understanding and our readiness to pay the price of this painful, extremely painful war, right? And be able to go all the way and do what is needed to be able to effectively win and prevent this from happening again.
I can just tell a story. In 2014, I forget which operation, I think you mentioned it, the operation in 2014 in Gaza, I was then in the Strategic Affairs Ministry, which then was called the Intelligence Ministry, and the minister was Yuval Steinitz, and he was involved in all of the intimate discussions with the prime minister and the defense minister about this operation. And we'd have discussions in the ministry about strategies and tactics, and I remember somebody suggested, well, why don't we go and capture all of Gaza and eliminate Hamas? And then right away, around the table was mostly former Mossad officials, former Shabak officials. And by the way, they said, no, that can't be done. And the price is too high. And you don't understand how complicated that is. And we shouldn't even talk about that. And Steinitz, to his credit, banged on the table and said, we can decide whether that's the right strategy or not. But if we want to tell ourselves that that's impossible, that's beyond what we're capable of, then we should just close up shop and leave the Middle East because we have nothing to do here. We have to at least take that, think seriously about that possibility. Obviously, that's not what Israel chose to do at the time.
I think you're 100% right. I mean, you know, Usher, let's talk about Bibi for a moment, okay? There's two things to say about Netanyahu. Number one is that he has long been very hesitant to use military force, which is not a bad thing necessarily. But he also had not had any real trust or confidence in the IDF ground forces. Netanyahu is a big believer in standoff capabilities. So, you know, putting an F-35 somewhere up in the Middle East and having them drop a bomb and seeing it land and everything goes okay and that's it. But the idea of sending in the infantry brigades and divisions and armor and engineering corps and more into a place like Gaza, that's something that he never wanted to do. I mean, go back to 2014. He refused, and there was pressure, immense pressure, by Naftali Bennett then at the time, who I actually was working for at the time, to push into Gaza with forces because of the tunnels. Netanyahu did not agree. And only after they started popping out of the tunnels did Netanyahu finally acquiesce and agree to send the forces in, but in a very limited operation. After October 7th, he was very hesitant once again to send in the troops. I totally understand. I'm not judging, but I think he was scared of what the repercussions would be, mostly for Israelis. And would the IDF be able to succeed? And would it be able to do what needs to be done? People had to go talk to him and convince him that it's possible. And listen, there were real reasons to be suspicious or wary. The IDF had just failed miserably in something as basic as just defending the border. Now we think that they're going to be able to go into Gaza and defeat this enemy so heavily entrenched and embedded in civilian infrastructure. Look at how we're still almost 2 years into this war, and we're still almost every week discovering another strategic tunnel somewhere in the Gaza Strip, right? This was going to be a very long haul, very difficult war. So he had reasons to be wary. But I think that with that wariness also came an underlying belief, ultimately, that this is also the best that we can do, and that we cannot do much more than just maintain the conflict. And eventually, I think also, to some extent, and this is what I alluded to before, I think that for Netanyahu specifically, Hamas, I hate using the word asset because it makes it seem like he wanted Hamas and he wanted to build up Hamas, but it became something of a political asset. By the way, the word itself was not me who used it first. It was Bezalel Smotrich, the finance minister, who said a number of years ago that Hamas is an asset because it's one of the best reasons why we can say there is no reason, there's no viability to a Palestinian state. And I think that Netanyahu, alongside his deep conviction that he needs to protect and defend the state of Israel, and he deserves, by the way, this also has to be said, he deserves the blame for October 7th, and he deserves the credit for the reengineering of the Middle East post-October 7th. But I think that he did see in Hamas an asset when he was under the pressure, immense pressure, definitely from the Obama administration, to make moves towards a Palestinian state. Having a divided Palestinian people was not a bad thing, necessarily.
I want to ask you another political question. The deep political divisions in 2023 are something that I think both sides blame for October 7th, right? The left will say that the existence of judicial reform at all was too divisive, and that's what weakens people. And on the right, they'll say that the protests against it, which included people calling on people to refuse to report to reserve duty, was what caused it. But to what degree do you think that the really deep divisions in Israeli society and politics at that time impacted Hamas's decision to attack and also Israel's blindness to it?
Well, I think, Lahav, that without a doubt, the judicial reform was a huge distraction for the government and for the Israeli people. The right will say that the left and the protesters, and especially those who were the reservists who threatened to not follow orders and not call up, you know, he'd call up orders, they weakened the military and they opened up the door to our enemy. And the left, or the anti-judicial reform protesters, would say the government and its refusal to stop and open up lines of communication and be willing to understand that we were weakening ourselves and dividing ourselves made us vulnerable, made us exposed. Whatever it is, however you look at it, in the end, the responsibility is upon the government. The government was the one who started this initiative of judicial reform. By the way, I support many aspects of judicial reform. But I also had issues with the fact that the process was moving forward without really an attempt to reach a compromise, without stopping to listen. And we all remember those pivotal moments from January up to October. For example, when Yoav Gallant, who was the defense minister, gave a speech and warned of security risks, and he was just immediately fired. That was later retracted because of the protests that broke out. The story of Herzi Halevi, the chief of staff, who goes to the Knesset and tries to meet with Netanyahu as they're voting on one of the key issues of the reform, and Netanyahu refuses to hear him. So then there were, we later discovered, we, the Israeli people, later discovered, and we tell these stories also in the book, about the letters that the heads of military intelligence sent to the prime minister, also warning. No one was able to put their finger on Hamas. No one was able to say Hamas is planning an invasion. But there was a feeling and a sense that through the weakness that we were projecting to the world and to our adversaries, they would take advantage of it. I mean, I knew no intelligence, and I'm no prophet, but on the eve of Yom Kippur of 2023, which was the 50th anniversary to the Yom Kippur War of 1973, the last great strategic surprise of the state of Israel, when we were not just surprised and then thrown into our bloodiest debacle with the war with Egypt and Syria, but I said, I don't understand something. We're at each other's throats. We're ripping ourselves apart on the streets. 50 years ago happened the worst war that we've known until now. If we saw this division on the streets of Tehran or Damascus, would we not try to fan the flames just a bit to achieve our objectives in those countries and among our adversaries? Why would we think they would not do the same to us? But there were also other reasons that Hamas decided to launch this attack at this moment. There was the Saudi normalization that seemed to be coming, and they wanted to block it. There was the fact, and later we discovered this in conversations with intelligence folks, was that Sinwar had some sort of belief, Yahya Sinwar, the leader of Hamas, that the alliance between Israel and the United States had been weakened, and that the Americans under then President Biden would not stand with Israel in the event of an attack, in the event of a war. He was wrong, right? We all know. I mean, there's much to talk about and unpack in that statement, but he was wrong, definitely, in the immediate aftermath of October 7th. The support of the Biden administration was remarkable in terms of weapons, in terms of President Biden making his historic wartime visit to Israel just, 10, 11 days after the war began. Very unequivocal support that that started to erode over time, and we're all familiar with the now 2,000-pound bombs that they stopped the delivery of. But for the most part, I think that was something that he thought would play to his advantage, and it did not. And of course, there's also, you know, bring the Palestinian issue back to the forefront of the world's agenda. And what I always say is just also, they're a genocidal terrorist group. I mean, they don't need an excuse really to want to kill and attack us. It's something they wake up to every single day. Terrorists like Hamas and Islamic Jihad seek our very destruction. This is what they ultimately desire.
In your very thorough research for the book, and but it should have been at the very opening, but I want to highly recommend all of our listeners and viewers to go out and buy the book, and not delay, but to go out and buy the book. I think you'll learn a lot, as you can already hear from this conversation. But in all of your talks with the former generals and intelligence officials and government ministers, other officials, who, whatever the Concepcion or their, or whatever else was going on, the distractions, it was actually their job, whether their job was to gather the intelligence, their job was to put the troops in place to respond to these events, their job was to make sure that in the event of attack, the lines of communication didn't break down, their job in the case of the cabinet, in the case of the prime minister, their job was to determine national strategy and identify threats. And I think it's pretty clear that all along, from the people who were putting the troops in place on the ground to the prime minister who was determining national strategy, there were many, many failures. So when you speak to the people who were involved in these decision-making and in this analysis, what do you hear from them now?
It's a good question. I mean, first of all, great regret, right? That has to be said. And I've heard from not one and not two, definitely people in the security establishment, because let's also remember is that the security establishment has pretty much been purged and replaced since October 7th. Ronen Bar, the head of the Shin Bet, is no longer in his role. Herzi Halevi is no longer in his role as the chief of staff. Yaron Finkelman is no longer in his role as the head of the Southern Command. Avi Rosenfeld is no longer in his role as the head of the Gaza Division. Khalifa is the head of, I mean, I could go on and on and on. Unlike, by the way, the political establishment, where they're all still in their job somehow, without a feeling that they need to be held accountable or pay a personal price, which is a whole other conversation about Israeli accountability and culture, which I have a lot of issues with, as you might tell. But anyhow, what I hear from many of them is how the images come back to them all the time and how they, I mean, I'll tell you what one told me, very senior, that during the war, it used to come to him at night. But since he has left his job, it's all the time. These are scars. I mean, you know, they're not. Are they victims? Kind of also. They're victims in the bigger story to an extent, right? They were responsible on that day. They failed in their basic job. They had one job. Watch Gaza. Keep Hamas where it was. Man the border. And they failed. And they should be held accountable. And they shouldn't be in their jobs anymore. But they're also victims of the bigger concepcia and of the way, because the failure belongs to us all. That's how I look at it. Everyone in government, everyone in the military and security and intelligence establishment. I even would go as far as to say people in journalism failed to ask the tough questions, to hold our leaders accountable. I was in those briefings with the intelligence and military leaders where they would talk about the threat matrix of Israel, and Hamas was barely mentioned, right? And no one pushed back and said, but one second, but Sinwar is saying that where he's coming for us. I mean, do you not believe the guy, right? And people, it wasn't even talked about. So I think that, you know, I hear definitely the pain and the guilt and the burden that many of them will carry for the rest of their lives, no question. I also hear from definitely people in the government that they failed to recognize, and this I've heard from not one or two ministers, but more, they failed to recognize the severity of the Hamas threat. They didn't understand, they say now looking back, what a strategic threat it was and what this war and what this attack would draw Israel into, how Hamas could orchestrate what eventually would become known, as the prime minister has called it, a seven-front war. That was something that Hamas was not believed to have the ability to do, not to mention, of course, not to have the ability to carry out an attack like October 7th, where they killed, massacred 1,200 people and took 251 people hostage.
Looking forward, do you think that the IDF has sort of put into place new structures, new procedures to try to make sure that something like this doesn't happen again? I'll just tell you, you talked about Yom Kippur, right? 2 weeks before the October 7th attack happened. So I interviewed Avigdor Kaalani, the hero of the Yom Kippur War, about, you know, what we could learn today, right? And it was before October 7th. And he had talked about things that had been put into place, that Israelis look at their intelligence differently, that they bring sort of two opposing views and make sure to have out that debate. And then, you know, 2 weeks later, this happened. And obviously, I mean, Avigdor Kalani had no way of knowing, but it made me think that sometimes even the best proceed, like, you know, even when you think you learned your lesson, you don't know. But what do you think, looking at the way the IDF is behaving now?
I think the IDF has learned a lot of those lessons, and I think it's implementing them. I think that it has made structural intelligence reforms. Maybe it might need more, but I think that there is no doubt that today there's much closer coordination between the Shin Bet and the IDF, and of course the Mossad as well, in the flow of the intelligence and making sure information doesn't get stuck at the bottom and it makes its way up to the decision makers and everybody's aware of what the other has. So there's a better flow and there's better coordination. I think there's more vigilance today by the IDF in the way it watches the borders along Israel. And I think that in general, that preemptive policy of if you see just a rocket being moved or you see a bad guy driving in a car or you see a tunnel being dug, we're now applying it very much in Lebanon, you see, right? And where there still are, ever since almost a year now, to the ceasefire, Israel continues to operate pretty freely in Lebanon. And it does so because this is part of that new policy. I think that in the aftermath of whatever, however this war does end, that will be integral to keep Hamas from reconstituting itself into the way that it could pose another major strategic threat to Israel. But, and here's the big but, all is good as long as you do, if you maintain that vigilance. But eventually quiet will set in, and I fear that Israel will fall back in love with the quiet and will neglect to some extent the vigilance that it will require to prevent the Hamas from being able to recoup itself and reconstitute itself. Will Hamas have the ability to launch another October 7th? I mean, I hear people say they'll be able to do it again. I'm highly skeptical, right? That they'll be able to do anything of the scale or scope of this in the few years to come. But you have to prevent them from rebuilding and reconstituting. And that will require a major effort that Israel has never really done. I mean, we fought wars, we walked away and threw away the key, but we've never maintained this success. The one place where we did do that was in the West Bank, where after Operation Defensive Shield, in April 2002, when it was launched after the Park Hotel bombing, Israel created it created operational freedom, and then it retained the operational freedom. So in the now 24 years almost since, Israel goes in and out goes in and out of the West Bank as it will, as it sees fit, and it carries out operations as it wants. In Gaza, is that possible? Now, Israel talks about retaining operational security and freedom and independence. The prime minister talks about that. But the proof will be in the pudding. And it will be if Israel actually does do that in the long haul. And if it sees something happening in Gaza City, it sends in the troops and it goes after it, right? If it doesn't do that and it just says, you know what, we'll jot down where the target is, we'll build up the target bank, that's falling right back into the trap that we were in that led to October 7th.
Yaakov, you talk in the book a lot about the importance of maintaining unity, the unity as a component in national, these are my words, but unity as a component of national security, of national resilience, and I fully agree. But on the other hand, there are some really deep or really difficult questions, really difficult moral strategic dilemmas, which are happening right now, right? The question of, let's say there was a deal, just to make things simple, to get all the hostages back and to leave Hamas in power, whether formally in power or as the dominant military and government power on the ground de facto, if you have some sort of technocratic government. Now, there are very real strategic and moral dilemmas there, right? On the other hand, we obviously want every single one of the hostages back home as quickly as possible. On the other hand, there's this danger that Hamas rebuilds in a year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years from now, launches attacks again, inspires other attacks. How do you promote or create unity when there are really deep divisions, and in some ways legitimate divisions, legitimate debates over very fateful questions?
Well, first of all, I admit I was not. I think one of the things that struck me about October 7 was I didn't realize how integral, maybe this is obvious to other people, but I guess it just never settled in my mind, of how much unity impacts national security, right? And I think that as a journalist, and I was the editor of the newspaper in that period of judicial reform, you kind of get caught up in the moment, but you're not recognizing how impactful this is and what the consequences could be long term. So in my mind, and yes, we do spend some time talking about unity in the book and its impact on resilience and the ability to stay focused and not to fall into a state of complacency or become exposed and vulnerable for enemies to take advantage of. I believe that is so, so important for national security. With that said, we're kind of back at it. And you're right. The issues that we're dealing with are extremely complicated and very difficult. And it's very disturbing, by the way, at times, that the conversations that people have about hostages and should they be prioritized? Should they not be prioritized? Should we operate as if they're not there? What do we do? And I think that one of Hamas's greatest successes here, by the way, was the fact that to borrow the phrase from Passover, from Pesach, had they just killed, and I don't mean just killed because it was horrific, but had they just killed 1,200 people, Dayenu, right? But they killed 1,200 people, and they took 251 to Gaza. And you're right, is what it did from day one. You and I, we could have sat here. And I could have said to you, guys, we're going to win this war because we're going to bring down Hamas. We're going to eliminate it. We're going to stop it from being the governing entity of Gaza. But the hostages, we won't get back. And you could have looked at me and said, you're crazy. That's not a victory. And I could have told you the opposite. We're going to win this war because we're going to get back the hostages, but Hamas will remain in power. And you would have said also, legitimately, what are you talking about? That's not a victory. Hamas is still in power. So from the beginning, Israel has been stuck in this very complex situation where it needs both, and both are very difficult to achieve. And this is one of the reasons this war has dragged on for so long. I believe that if there weren't hostages now at all, the war would have ended much earlier, right? Part of this is because we the Israeli people, and I think this is something that the world does not recognize. We, the Israeli people, are still very much hurting, are still very much in our trauma. And as long as the hostages remain in Gaza, and there's 48 as we record this, right? 20 believed to be alive, 28 bodies, and we're not even sure about all of the 20, but 48 are there. As long as they are there, the Israeli people will not be able to recover, rehabilitate, and heal. And this will make this conflict, unfortunately, continue. So I think that ultimately what can create a semblance of unity, and unity is a big word, I agree, Asher, but I think that one of the problems that we do have is we don't have a real articulation of what it is that we're trying to do. Our government keeps, for a variety of reasons, what its plans are very close to its chest. It talks about how we have to stop Hamas as the governing entity and bring it down, but it doesn't talk about what will replace it. It talks about how it wants to get back the hostages, but we don't really know. And it seems that when deals are presented, Netanyahu says initially yes, but then goes a different way. When Hamas wanted a complete comprehensive deal, he wanted a phase deal. Now that they want a phase deal, he wants a comprehensive deal. And by the way, I think there's legitimacy in his insistence right now as we speak on a comprehensive deal. But I think it also creates this very great deal of suspicion within the Israeli public of whether he's motivated by politics or not, and what is the underlying interest. So together, that doesn't make it simple to align at all on what the national interest should be right now.
So let's shift to something different. You are the co-founder of the Middle East America Dialogue, which is starting around when this podcast will be released. You want to tell our listeners what is the goal of MEAD and sort of what initiatives, what has come out of it?
MEAD was created after October 7th. In the initial stage, it was basically from a belief that there was a vacuum in Washington, D.C. in particular, for deep conversations between Israel, the United States, and the wider Middle East. There used to be something that maybe some of our listeners are familiar with called the Sipan Forum back in the day, that it was really one of the premier elite forums between, very focused just on Israel, U.S., and their relationship. And that had stopped in 2017. And since then also with AIPAC, which stopped its big policy conference back in 2020, there had opened up a vacuum in Washington and in America for high-level policy discussions between the administration and the Congress and with their Israel and wider Middle Eastern allies, I long believed that there was an opportunity to do something in Washington. And after October 7th, was able to raise the funds and try to kick it off, but with a couple of tweaks to the way things used to be back under the Sipan Forum, let's say. Number one was bipartisanship is extremely important. So it's not just the Democrats and it's not just the Republicans, but we have people from both sides of the aisle, whether in the House, in the Senate, and also the current administration and the former administration. So really bringing together all of the different people for a look in the past, to be able to look to the future, to look at current policy, and to engage with people who were in those roles in the past, but will likely, as all three of us know, Washington is a revolving door. They do often come back, more than often. And then the other—
As is Jerusalem, by the way, to a sense.
As is Jerusalem,
as a former advisor to ministers.
And the second big tweak was that it's not just Israel and the U.S., it's the Middle East and the U.S., and that's why we called it the Middle East-America Dialogue. The Abraham Accords created a major opportunity to really do something in a way that can bring Arab countries and Arabs together alongside Israelis for conversations with the Americans. And we have been lucky to build up, I think, confidence and trust among Arabs to understand that this is a place where they have a stage, where they are respected, where their voice is no different than the Israeli voice. And we've had even representatives of countries, number of countries with which Israel does not have official lines of communication. And even some that it has fought wars with over the last 2 years, or with entities within those countries, let's say. And they come and there's engagement. To say that they all talk together and they sing Kumbaya, you know, that's not happening. But I believe in dialogue. I believe that communication is super important, and I think that it has the opportunity to do something, to move something, you know, move the needle. It's difficult to quantify or give a metric exactly how, but we do. So we do Washington conference, we do an Abu Dhabi conference, also now one in the Arab world. We had in April, five foreign ministers from the region who came together. The Jordanian, the Egyptian, the Emirati, the Israeli, the Azeri. So it really, you know, it's become a place where people want to come and converse and talk.
What if anything, because you've been doing this every, you know, once every half year, what if anything is different this time? We saw reports about warnings from the UAE that Israel applying sovereignty in the West Bank and Judea and Samaria could lead to a breakdown of the Abraham Accords. On the other hand, we've seen how Israel is, you know, essentially reshaping the region in many ways following as the Seven Front War progresses. We see President Trump showing some very strong supporter of Israel. Of course, there are different voices within the Republican Party, but the president himself has come out very strongly in support of Israel. We saw his recent trip to the Gulf, where he talked about the importance of U.S. Gulf relations. So as you come together this September in Washington, what is different than half a year ago or a year ago?
Well, I think that there's the depressing part that's different, and maybe there's the optimistic part that's different. The depressing part that's different is that I think people who might have been more hopeful in the past that this war was going to end, and when it ends, it will take us, the region, back onto a track towards normalization, are now of the opinion and feeling that normalization is farther away today than it was half a year ago, or definitely a year ago. A year ago at the at Mead in Washington, we had Princess Rima, the Saudi ambassador, who came. And it was really, and she spoke in a very, it was very inspiring to hear her and to talk about what could happen if the war were to end. And I think that that was a very hopeful time. It was a terrible time, but it was a hopeful time that we were already almost a year into the war. And maybe something, Israel could get on a track towards ending it. At least this was what the hope that she expressed. And we could get back on the track towards regional integration. A year later from that, that hope I don't see and I don't sense. And I definitely think that, and you both know this, the Saudi normalization is much farther away today than excuse me, than it was in the past. The hopeful part, or the optimistic part, is that with that said, we do have at Mead in September in Washington, large delegations of Arabs that are participating, coming from various countries, from Egypt, from Jordan, from the UAE, from Qatar, from Lebanon. So we have people who are coming, who are participating in these conversations, and they want to engage and they want to talk to mostly the Americans, right? Because they're the focus of the conference. But there are Israelis in the room, and there are Israelis who are there. But the attention and the spotlight is on what is, and this is where what we believe is what the needle or the thread that connects all of these different countries, is that everybody wants, I think, and I believe, they want to see an engaged America in the Middle East. And this is what can connect us all. I mean, you know, there's a lot that can connect us: technology, the fight against Iran, and so much more, and other mutual interests. But when we look at the interest in the U.S., it's they want it. The region is tired of this yo-yo or constant gymnastic of what are they going to do now? It was Biden one way. Now it's Trump. Is it becoming isolationist? Is it not? And even on the Democratic side, are they moving in an isolationist way? Are they not? And they are very concerned, and everybody understands that it is in their interest, at least in these moderate countries, the ones that Israel does have relations with and the ones that I think we aspire to have relations with, that they are, that an engaged America in the Middle East makes the Middle East safer and creates greater opportunity for regional integration that will see a more secure and safe Israel.
Yaakov, thank you so much for joining us. I highly recommend everybody go out and pick up your new book and to really get a deeper sense of what happened, but just as importantly, what we need to do to ensure that something like that doesn't happen in the future, and how we build a more secure and stable and prosperous future for Israel and for the entire region. So thank you so much for joining us, and look forward to being in touch again soon.
Thanks, Yaakov.
Thank you, Asher. Thank you, Lahav.
Thank you for listening. We also want to thank our producer, Yaniv Morozovsky. Please make sure to subscribe to the podcast, to like and follow the Misgav Institute on social media. And you can read articles from Misgav's great fellows at www.misgavins.org. You can send your comments, questions, and suggestions to MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com. And we'll see you next week.